Made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents Cross Currents Between Film and Concert Music by Don Davis, composer of many film scores, including The Matrix, Wednesday, February 25th at 4 p.m. in the auditorium, room 2100 of the Music Building, 1114 West Nevada Street, Urbana, on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. It's just coming up on 7 minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time, and today Celeste Quinn is off. She'll return tomorrow. We have an interview from the archives coming up, first broadcast last February, so please no phone calls today. And a reminder that Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac will follow this archived interview here on the Afternoon Magazine.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. I have been in sorrow's kitchen and licked out all the pots. Then I have stood on the peaky mountain wrapped in rainbows with a harp and a sword in my hands. Those words from Zora Neale Hurston open a new biography of the writer. They were chosen as the epigraph for Valerie Boyd's biography of Hurston, Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Hurston, who was born in 1891 and died in 1960, wrote novels, short stories, plays, journal articles, and an autobiography. Her work has influenced later writers, including Alice Walker and Toni Morrison. Hurston was also an anthropologist and folklorist. Of folklore, she said, quote, "Folklore is the boiled-down juice of human living." And she collected stories and songs and other information in the southern U.S. and in the Caribbean. Her best-known novel is Their Eyes Were Watching God. That book and many of her works were republished beginning in the 1970s. Their Eyes Were Watching God was the first to be republished. It was republished in 1978 by the University of Illinois Press. Hurston biographer Valerie Boyd is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments for Valerie Boyd. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little something about Valerie Boyd. She's arts editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Her articles, essays, and reviews have also appeared in other publications, including Book, Ms., The Oxford American, The Washington Post, and African American Review. Her book, Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston, is published by Scribner. Valerie Boyd, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you,
this afternoon.
It's my pleasure to be here.
What was your introduction to Zora Neale Hurston?
My introduction to her was like so many other people's introduction to her. It was her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which, as you just pointed out, is her most famous novel. It was published in 1937. I read that book in about 1981. I was a freshman in college. I was 17 or 18 years old, and I read this book, and I was just amazed that somebody could have written a book in the 1930s that still spoke to me so resonantly through the decades. And I was really intrigued by the book because it was about a black woman named Janie Crawford. It was about her her journey to discover herself. And at 17 or 18 years old, I was at the beginning of that journey for myself. And so I was just drawn to the book and drawn to the writer. I wanted to know who was behind this amazing book. And that's when I first became introduced to Zora Neale Hurston and wanted to know everything I could find out about her.
Hmm. Janie's character, Janie Crawford, that character was quite a departure for a black woman in a novel in the 1930s, wasn't it?
It was, and it was really one of the very first novels where a black woman was the central character and was on a quest to know herself. Janie marries three times in the course of the book. She leaves her first husband. She's really an independent spirit and searching to know who she is, and she's doing that initially through relationships, but she's also searching for her own voice, and that was a departure in literature in the 1930s.
Mm. The power of the characters in this novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, are Hurston's other novels peopled with characters as strong as these?
I think they are. Her first novel, Jonas Gårdvin, which was published in 1934, 3 years before Their Eyes Were Watching God, is a fictionalized account of her parents' marriage, and the main characters are named after her parents. Lucy and John Hurston were her parents, and in the book, they're Lucy and John Pearson. And the main character, John, is really he's a minister who is sort of struggling with the demands of his role as a minister and balancing that with sort of the demands of his flesh. He becomes kind of a philanderer, and he's really trying to, to heed the call of the spirit rather than the call of the flesh. So that's the kind of struggle that John is engaged in that novel. And then her third novel, the novel after Their Eyes Were Watching God, which was her second, her third novel is called Moses, Man of the Mountain. And it's a retelling of the biblical tale of Moses. And it's really a wonderful and amazing book about freedom, and about freedom being something internal, not something that can be given or taken away. So yes, all of her novels were really peopled by very vivid characters.
And now, are all of them back in print?
Yes, they are. They are. All of her, she wrote seven books in her lifetime, seven books that she published in her lifetime, and all of them are now back in print. They're the four novels, the three that I just mentioned, and then her fourth novel, Seraph on the Sewanee. And she wrote two books of folklore, Mules and Men and Tell My Horse, and her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road, and all of those, thankfully, are available now.
Yeah. Well, when I read Their Eyes Were Watching God, it was the first one that was available again, and it was quite an eye-opener. And I haven't had time to go and read the others, but now, after reading Wrapped in Rainbows, I'm ready.
Okay, great.
Let's talk about Their Eyes Were Watching God, because for her it was that novel was so important, and today it is praised highly. It is praised today as a novel of powerful black love and as protest literature. It was praised at the time of its publication, but not like that, not as a novel of black love and as protest literature. How was it seen in 1937?
Well, it was praised by, sort of by the establishment critics. It got a rave review in the New York Times and other kinds of publications like that. But there were several black male critics of Hurston's who really critiqued the book quite harshly. And their criticism might have had something to do with sexism, just because the book was focused on the internal life of a black woman. Richard Wright, in particular, found the novel quite lacking. He said the sensory sweep of the novel carries no theme, no message, no thought. So he was quite dismissive of Their Eyes Were Watching God, and part of that, I think, had to do with the fact that it was about the internal life of a black woman, which he found not very interesting. Mm. Also, in Wright's case, and in the case of Alan Locke and Sterling Brown and some of Hurston's other black male critics, their criticism of her, and specifically of this novel, centered around the fact that it was not overtly political. It was about the internal workings of a black community. As you point out, it's a love story. It's a story of a woman's quest to know herself and to know real love. And it's often thought of now as sort of a proto-feminist novel. And in that way, it is political, but at the time it was published, in the 1930s and even in the 1940s, a lot of black writers, especially black male writers like Richard Wright, wanted to write books that very overtly addressed racism and white oppression. And Hurston refused to write about that sort of thing directly. She was aware of racism and the existence of it, but she didn't want to write sociology. She wanted to write novels. She said, you know, I'm interested in what makes a man or a woman do such and so, regardless of color. You know, so she was interested in dealing with those kinds of themes that we all deal with, regardless of color. You know, love, loyalty, trust, and those are the kinds of issues that come to the fore in Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Hmm. A couple of things that strike me about the novel after reading about its origins and its creation in your book, Wrapped in Rainbows. Hurston's understanding of the yearnings of Janie and the connection she had to people and their speech. I was also struck by the connection Hurston had to the geography, the actual place, the climate and the plants, the feel of the southern U.S. and the Caribbean. She loved the heat of the sun. She loved hurricanes as long as she was, you know, not being swept off off the land by a hurricane. And she wrote this novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, while she was in Haiti, immersed in her anthropological field study. Maybe you would talk with us a little bit about her connections to people in place.
Well, Hurston grew up in the South, in the Black South, the segregated Black South. She was born in 1891 in a small town in Alabama, but her family moved to Eatonville, Florida, when she was just a toddler. And Eatonville is just outside of Orlando. It's about 10 minutes away from Orlando. And it was and still is an all-Black town. And when Zora was growing up there in the early 1900s, Eatonville was just an amazingly healthy, thriving community. And there she really saw examples of Black achievement all around her. Because it was an all-Black community, the mayor was Black, the town council members were Black, you know, the Sunday school teachers, the school teachers, everyone around her was Black, and so she got this strong sense of identity and strong sense of her own potential to do whatever she wanted to do. She didn't see any limitations around her, and because she was shielded from racism in a way, she was never indoctrinated in a sense of inferiority. And so this upbringing in this healthy Black community really made her the woman that she would become. And she loved the South. She loved Florida, the Florida sunshine, the Florida sunsets. And she always, you know, considered Florida home and loved the natural beauty of Florida and the South in general, and would always come back to Florida. She moved to Harlem in 1925 and became a leading light of the Harlem Renaissance. And she, you know, kind of worked there, and we think of her as a Harlem Renaissance writer, but in fact, she always went back to Florida when she was ready to write. She said, I can do hack work in New York, but to really write, I need the Florida sunshine. And so she wrote five of her books in Florida, and the other two, Dust Tracks on a Road, she wrote in California. And Their Eyes Were Watching God, she wrote, as you pointed out, in Haiti.
Mm-hmm. She would go back and forth, though, between the South and New York. I thought that was interesting all through her life.
Yes, really. She, as I said, she went to Florida to write, to just really get away from the distractions of New York. She loved New York and loved participating in the social life of New York. And, of course, New York is where she really fell in love with anthropology. She studied anthropology at Barnard College in New York, and later did some graduate work at Columbia University in New York. So she, you know, she found a great deal of value and a wonderful social outlet in New York. But to really write, she needed the peace and quiet of the South.
Yeah, she needed a lot of peace and quiet. I really admire that about her.
Mm-hmm.
Whether she was at teaching in North Carolina or in Florida, she had to be by herself to do her work.
Yeah, she really valued solitude. And, you know, that again came from her childhood in Eatonville. She had seven siblings, six brothers and one sister. But she sort of stood apart and always thought of herself. She was quite an imaginative child. And so she was always making up stories in her head and that sort of thing. So she developed this way of standing apart and retreating into her imagination. And she really valued her solitude, which continued throughout her life.
Yeah. Your biography opens with a wonderful story of Hurston as a child. She was quite comfortable. She and her family were quite comfortable. But you say Zora needed more. She needed to know, quote, for instance, what the end of the world was like, whether it was sort of tucked under, like the hem of a dress, or if it was just a sharp drop-off into the nothingness. So when she was about 9, she decided to walk out to the horizon and see. Of course, she didn't get there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that story. She recounts that story in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road, and I was drawn to that story because it really, at that point, she was 9 years old, and it really, to me, just kind of signifies her adventurousness, her adventurous spirit, even as a child. And I think her adventurous spirit we see throughout her life, even in her anthropological work. I mean, she went to Haiti, she went to Jamaica, she went to Honduras. You know, there was all this work that she did studying cultures, studying the ordinary cultures of people of color in these communities. And, you know, that adventurous spirit that she developed as a child is what, you know, carried her through her voodoo studies in Haiti, for instance, or her studies with the Maroon people of Jamaica.
Now, her parents saw her spirit and her imagination quite differently from one another. John was more reserved, and Lucy, her mother, Lucy Hurston, encouraged her daughter, encouraged all her children, I believe.
Right. She encouraged them all to jump at the sun, as she put it.
Yeah.
She said, you might not land on the sun, but at least you get off the ground. John Hurston, Zora's father, on the other hand, really, I think, was aware in an acute way of the kind of racism and racial limitations that lurked just outside the boundaries of Eatonville. And he felt that it didn't do, as he put it, for Negro children to have so much spirit, you know. So he wanted to kind of school his children in humility, and that was a hard lesson for Zora to learn. She was quite opinionated and adventurous and outspoken, even as a child, and he felt that she had too much mouth for her own good, and so, you know, he and Zora were always in conflict over that, and Lucy, as Zora put it, always stood between them, you know, that her mother just adored her and encouraged her in every way.
Mm. So because she and her father were often in conflict, it wasn't long before Zora Neale Hurston found herself out on her own at a very young age.
Yeah, her mother died, unfortunately, when Zora was just 13 years old. And at that point, the conflict between Zora and her father only escalated. Her father, John Hurston, very quickly remarried. He married a much younger woman, a woman who was just 20 years old. She was just a few years older than Zora and younger, in fact, than some of Zora's older brothers. And so this quick remarriage really hurt all of the children. And this woman, the new Mrs. Hurston, just wasn't interested in and perhaps didn't even have the ability to deal with this house full of children. So John Hurston began to kind of send the kids away to school. He sent Zora away to school in Jacksonville. And soon after that, he no longer paid her tuition, so she came back home but had problems getting along with her stepmother and eventually was kind of sent to live with various relatives. And that was the beginning of a period in Hurston's life that was really difficult for her. She called these years her haunted years. And she really was out on her own and struggling to make a living, working menial jobs, working as a maid or as a babysitter, anything she could find, and only sporadically going to school. And she was a teenager during these years and really had a difficult time finishing her high school education and sort of disappeared from the public record during this period, too. It's a period of almost 10 years. And when Zora resurfaces on the public record in 1917, she's in Baltimore, Maryland. And she shows up there. Her sister, her older sister, is living in Baltimore at this time. And Zora's 26 years old and hasn't yet finished high school. And so this year, 1917, was the year when she began to reinvent herself. In Baltimore, public schooling was free to people up to age 20. So in order to qualify for this free public schooling, Zora lopped 10 years off of her life and told school officials she was 16.
Yeah.
And in that way was able to go to school and finish her high school education.
Yeah.
She'd always been told that she looked young for her age. And she took, you know, she took advantage of that by passing as a teenager so she could finish school.
Mm. Now, from that point on, she left those 10 years and I believe sometimes more off her age.
Yes, she was always at least 10 years older than she presented herself at any given time. But she also had no qualms about lopping off additional years when it worked to her benefit. For instance, when she was 48 years old, she married a 23-year-old man, and she gave her age on the marriage certificate as 29.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Although that marriage was unfortunate.
Yeah, it was short-lived.
Didn't work out.
Didn't work out at all.
Yeah. So, okay, she's 26 years old. She goes back to high school. She says she's 16. And then from there, it's, what is it, Howard? And eventually she finds herself at Columbia. And
right. Yeah, I mean, she was an exceedingly bright student, and, you know, people quickly caught on to that. So she went to Morgan Academy, which is now Morgan State University in Baltimore. She was in the high school division. From there, she went to Howard University in D.C., and while at Howard, she really began to write and be published. She was published in the Howard University literary magazine called The Stylus. And the faculty advisors for that magazine recognized her talent and encouraged her talent. And then she wrote a story that was published in a magazine called Opportunity, which was based in New York. It was a national magazine. And her first nationally published short story was an Opportunity, and it was called Drenched in Light. And it was a beautiful kind of fictionalized account of her childhood. There's the main character in Drenched in Light is a little girl named Isis, and she's very clearly modeled on Zora herself. And so this was Zora's opening statement, literary statement to the world, so to speak. And the editor of Opportunity Magazine was so impressed with the story that he got in touch with Zora and just suggested that she might consider a move to New York, where this burgeoning black arts and culture movement that we now know as the Harlem Renaissance was in full flower. And Zora took this letter and used it as an invitation and packed up her bags, and she only had $1.50 in her purse. And with that, and what she said was a lot of hope, she moved to New York City in January of 1925. Mm. And while there, really kind of elbowed her way into the Harlem Renaissance, impressed some very influential people quite early in her time in New York, and was offered an opportunity to attend Barnard College, where she became its first black student.
Yeah. I want to go back to her first writings. It seems to me that right away that's when she realizes that's what she wants to do. While she wants to study anthropology, what she really wants to do is be a writer of fiction. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, I think she knew that she wanted to write very early, even when she was still in Eatonville, because she was always making up stories and really enjoying the storytelling tradition of Eatonville. Her father, as we mentioned earlier, was a Baptist minister, and so the preachers in the community would come and gather at their house and sit on the porch and tell stories. There was the general store, Joe Clark's store, right across the street from Zora Neale Hurston's house. And she would go there and hear the men and women of the community sitting on the porch telling stories. She was always drawn to these stories and to the richness of the language in Eatonville. The language of these self-educated black men and women was poetic and beautiful in Zora's ears. And so she always was drawn to that and sort of imbibed that language, and that language became the primary language of her own literature. So by the time she was at Howard even, she knew that she wanted to write. In the Howard yearbook in 1923, you know, her ambition was to move to the Greenwich Village and become a writer, a bohemian and a writer. So she knew then that she wanted to be a writer. But it was at Barnard that she was introduced to anthropology and saw this wonderful scientific way of looking at her community. You know, when she was in Eatonville as a child, she just sort of had an intuitive appreciation for the culture of Eatonville. So what anthropology did was gave her a scientific lens through which to look at, you know, at this culture that she had just appreciated sort of intuitively and organically. So she then became interested in anthropology as well, but never gave up that first love for writing.
Mm. Her interest in speech, the speech of Eatonville and beyond, she recognized it as powerful and poetic, but it also seems to me it is very musical, and she also had quite an interest in music.
She did. She did. I mean, Zora was quite an artist. She was interested in black folk culture and folk culture of all peoples in a broad way. Her specific interest in black folk culture manifested in an interest in music, in dance, in the language, the customs, the storytelling, the mannerisms of black people in the South especially. You know, that became the first place of her anthropological research while she was a student at Barnard and studying under Franz Boas, who was head of the anthropology department at Columbia University. She received a fellowship to study black folk culture, and when Professor Boas asked her, where does she want to go, she said, I want to go to Eatonville. And so she did her first real field work in Eatonville, and from Eatonville she branched out into other southern communities and collected folk songs, imitated the dances, and not imitated in a mocking way, but really learned the dances that people did in these communities and documented them. So yes, she was very much interested in black southern folk culture in a broad sense.
So now let's go forward to 1925 when she arrives in Harlem with $1.50 in her pocketbook.
She really very quickly became a leading light of the Harlem Renaissance. She met some of the other writers of that period, people like Langston Hughes, County Cullen, Wallace Thurman, Richard Bruce Nugent, Nella Larson, Jesse Fawcett. She became a part of this community and really found a kind of cultural and artistic home there in Harlem. You know, it was probably the strongest kind of black community that she had experienced since she left Eatonville as a child or as a teenager. So she really enjoyed living in Harlem and found camaraderie with these other writers. And so she and Langston Hughes and Wallace Thurman and some of the other writers of that period founded a magazine together called Fire, which they published in 1926. They could only afford to publish one issue, but it was an amazing publication that continues to influence writers and magazine publishers today. So she participated in the founding of Fire and also wrote several short stories during this period. It's interesting because we often think of Zora Neale Hurston as a Harlem Renaissance writer, but in fact, she didn't publish any books during the Harlem Renaissance. Her first books came later in the 1930s. Most historians really think about the Harlem Renaissance as a period in the 1920s that sort of ended in 1929 with the stock market crash. And so Hurston's published books came after the Harlem Renaissance, but she did write stories during the Harlem Renaissance and was just such a forceful and flamboyant in some ways personality of the Harlem Renaissance. So that's why we think of her as a Harlem Renaissance writer.
Yeah. Her first novel, Jonas Gord Vine, published, well, it was finished in 1933. I'm not sure if it was published that year.
Yeah, it was published in 1934.
And Their Eyes Were Watching God was finished in 36, published in 37.
Right.
So yeah, that's quite a number of years after.
Right.
After the Renaissance.
Yeah, so, I mean, she made that kind of mark on the Harlem Renaissance just with the force of her personality and with very promising short stories and plays that she wrote during the Harlem Renaissance years. She also, during those years of the 1920s, spent a good deal of time away from Harlem, actually in the South, doing her folklore research and her research in black conjure or hoodoo culture. And that research really informed her writing for many years to come. In 1927, she did the folklore research that we mentioned earlier that was sort of under the supervision of Franz Boas. And then in 1928 and 1929, she spent almost two solid years traveling through the South and doing more anthropological research, where she studied root doctors, conjure doctors, hoodoo doctors. Hoodoo is sort of the American cousin to voodoo. And so she studied this this form of religion in the South and studied it with great respect. She apprenticed herself to some of the conjure doctors in the South and did probably the most serious study of it that had been done at the time. And this is talked about in her book, Mules and Men. She talks about that research as well as the research she did collecting folk tales throughout the South.
Hmm. What was it like for her to be a woman traveling through the South collecting these stories and this information?
It was not without its dangers, as you can imagine. I mean, for even for a woman traveling alone in the South today, especially a black woman, I would imagine there would be some dangers. So we can scarcely fathom what it must have been like for a black woman traveling alone in the 1920s, when lynchings and rape and all kinds of racial and sexist violence was commonplace. You know, there's a famous photo of Zora Neale Hurston with a gun on her hip. And, you know, for years, I think people have looked at that photo and said, oh, what a character she was. But as I was doing this research, I found that it wasn't, you know, she didn't wear that gun on her hip to look cute. She needed it for protection. Her brother insisted that she buy a car and that she not travel on trains because, of course, she would have had to travel in the segregated cars, which were dangerous places for women traveling alone. So she bought a car, which she called Sassy Susie, you know, and she packed up this car and traveled all around the South with her pistol in tow.
Hmm. Journalist Valerie Boyd is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of a new biography of Zora Neale Hurston titled Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Let's go back and talk about her friendship with Langston Hughes, which eventually ended so sadly. There was a split between these two friends, and from the pictures that you include in the book, it looked like they had a, you know, you can see the friendship that they enjoyed.
Right. Yeah, they met in 1925, soon after Zora moved to New York, and they became good friends. As I mentioned earlier, they worked together on this magazine called Fire, and Langston Hughes was really, Zora Neale Hurston really regarded him as a confidant. They were quite close. When they met, it was actually at the at an awards dinner for Opportunity Magazine, where Zora won several awards, and a few days after that, Langston Hughes wrote to someone who he knew was a friend to both of them and said, Zora Neale Hurston is an interesting girl, isn't she? I think I'd like to know her better. And so that was really the beginning of their friendship, and they became quite close. It was a platonic friendship, but a very close friendship, and they maintained this friendship throughout Zora's travels through the South. In fact, in 1927, when she was she spent about 6 months in the South doing this anthropological research, and she was in Mobile, Alabama, and just ran into Langston Hughes there. He was there doing a sort of self-styled Southern book tour, and they ran into each other and decided to drive back to New York together from Alabama in Zora's car. And so that was really where their friendship solidified. And because they enjoyed traveling back together, they just meandered their way through the South and on their way back to New York. And their friendship continued throughout the 1920s, in 1928 and 1929, when Zora was spending about two solid years in the South. She was writing to Langston Hughes every week, and the letters that they exchanged during that period really are an amazing chronicle of her time spent in the South, because she was telling him all the details of her research and seeking his advice on various things. They were loaning each other money. So you just really get the sense of closeness in their friendship from reading those letters. And in 1930, when Zora moved back to New York after finishing her 2 years of field work, she and Langston Hughes began working on a play together called Mule Bone. It was a play based on a story that Zora Neale Hurston had grown up hearing in Eatonville, and she wanted Langston Hughes to collaborate with her on this play, and they started working on it together, and everything was going well for a time, and then things just sort of fell apart. From what I've been able to determine, the sort of root of the dispute was a woman named Louise Thompson. Louise was a literary secretary who'd been hired to work with them while they were completing this play. And Langston Hughes wanted to bring Louise in as a third collaborator. Hurston objected to this, but didn't fully express her views, but just sort of objected to it and then sulked a little bit about it. And that was the beginning of the disagreement between Langston and Zora. And that disagreement spiraled out of control very quickly and just kind of ended up with mutual accusations. They both accused each other of trying to steal the play from the other. And it really, from what I could tell, just seemed to be a series of misunderstandings that spiraled out of control, and they never were able to get to the truth and patch it up. And they both later regretted it. You know, years after their friendship ended in early 1931, Langston Hughes wrote to a mutual friend that he had turned over all the rights to Mule Bone to Zora, and he wondered if she was still mad with him. And even years after that, Zora told a mutual friend that her breakup with Langston Hughes had been the cross of her life. She said she still woke up at night crying about it.
Mm. You know, at some point in the book you say she never found an artistic soulmate, but Langston Hughes certainly came close.
Yeah, I think that they came close to being artistic soulmates, and that, you know, that potential was thwarted when they had this argument over Mule Bone. And I think it just really, this dispute over Mule Bone, which, by the way, was never produced in their lifetimes. I mean, they had such a falling out about it that they neither one of them ever went on to produce the play. So I think that dispute really ended one of the most promising literary friendships in the 20th century.
Mm. What led Hurston to such an interest in theater?
Her interest in theater began early, too, I believe. We talked earlier about her having these 10 haunted years, 10 or so years, where she was struggling to make a living and struggling to go to school. And she was also trying to make her way out of the South and up north where there might be more opportunities. And this, of course, was during the middle of the Great Migration, when many black Southerners were moving up north. And part of Zora's migration included an 18-month stint with the Gilbert and Sullivan theater troupe. She was not actually a performer. She was the maid to one of the singers in the troupe. But this was where she kind of cut her teeth on theater and became interested in theater and developed a real appreciation for it and a sophistication about theater just from watching these performances and being a part of this company of performers. So that's where her interest in theater began. And then when she started to do her anthropological field work, she was really convinced of the appropriateness of theater as an outlet for black folk culture. You know, she would hear people sitting on a porch telling a story, and she could automatically see it on the stage and felt like, you know, the stage was the perfect venue for expressing this kind of vivid imagery that she heard and saw all around her.
Hmm. The Harlem Renaissance drew to a close with the dawn of the Great Depression. And So Zora went and she finished two novels in the 30s. Also during the Depression, she worked for the Federal Writers Project. And at this time, she's a respected writer, but she's hired at a rate less than a junior editor. And the work she did was often left out. Maybe you would tell us about the reporting project on turpentine workers she did in Florida.
Yeah, Hurston did quite a bit of impressive field work when she was working with the Federal Writers Project. The turpentine project that you mentioned, she spent some time in a turpentine camp in Florida, in rural Florida, and you know, she was a black woman who was working for the government, so the workers trusted her and felt that she could do something on their behalf, so they told her about all kinds of inequities and atrocities, really, that were happening in the camp. And she was moved by these stories, and, you know, of course, she was there to collect folklore, to collect their, you know, their tall tales and their jokes and their humor and that sort of thing. But they were also telling her about some very serious issues, and she was moved by this experience and wrote a lot of this down and told some of, you know, her supervisors, but nothing was ever really done to help the people who were experiencing those kinds of atrocities. She wrote a good deal of interpretive and just recorded the kinds of stories and richness of imagination that she found in the turpentine camp and in other places where she did her research. But as you pointed out, a lot of it was not published. The Federal Writers Project was planning to do a book called The Florida Negro, where it would specifically look at black Floridians, and that that aspect of the work was never fully completed, never published for wide access. You know, some of the manuscripts that Hurston wrote for this publication do survive, but it was never published during her lifetime.
Yeah. All the field notes that she did, all the recordings she did, the films that she had a hand in, the Writers' Project pieces she produced but never saw it to print, do they survive?
Those written pieces do survive, and a lot of the Federal Writers' Project work that she did was recently gathered and published in a book called Go Gator and Muddy the Water, which was edited by a woman named Pamela Bordelon, and that was published recently. So if listeners are interested in just kind of getting a look at that material, I'd suggest that you take a look at that book. But and a lot of the anthropological research she did, the films that she did, the songs that she collected, a lot of that material survives at the Library of Congress. And the film footage that she shot is particularly amazing. She had a gifted kind of eye as a filmmaker. And, of course, during that period, the film equipment itself was very heavy, very cumbersome. So it's amazing to look at the images, the footage that she shot. And as I said, all of that is available at the Library of Congress, both the footage that she shot in the 1920s and then some footage that she shot later in the 1940s when she was doing some work with Alan Lomax and Mary Elizabeth Barnacle. Mm-hmm. And in that 1940s footage, Hurston is actually in some of the footage. And that's amazing to see, to actually see her moving around.
Any chance we'll see this in a documentary?
I'm not sure. I know that there are a couple of people who are working on documentaries about Hurston with aims to get them broadcast on PBS, and I'm sure they're aware of the footage. So we'll probably see it soon.
That'd be terrific. Before we go, we should talk about Hurston's racial politics and the controversies that they stirred up in the 40s and beyond in the 50s. She had kind of an unusual view, at least from where you and I sit in history. She seemed comfortable in segregation.
Yeah, it was her view of segregation was quite complex, and I think it was informed by her experience in Eatonville, this segregated black town that was a healthy community. In 1955, Hurston wrote a letter to a newspaper questioning the Brown versus Board of Education decision desegregating schools. And she drew a lot of flack from the NAACP and a lot of civil rights leaders because she just wondered, I mean, she felt that this Brown versus Board of Education decision was kind of affirming inferiority in black children by saying black children needed to sit next to white kids in order to get a better education, when that had not been her experience. Growing up in Eatonville, an all-black town where she went to an all-black school, she felt that she had gotten a perfectly fine education, and that if resources were put into black schools, black children could be educated just as well there. So she questioned this decision based on her own experience in a segregated and healthy community. So she just wondered what black America might lose by this sort of headlong rush toward integration.
Hmm. We have to leave it there because we're out of time. Valerie?
Oh, thank you so much, Celeste.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Valerie Boyd has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Wrapped in Rainbows, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. The book is published by Scribner.
And you've been listening to an interview from the archives, first broadcast 1 year ago at this time. Celeste Quinn returns tomorrow. We will have another archived interview in the 1 o'clock hour. The Emperor of Scent, A Story of Perfume Obsession, and The Last Mystery of the Senses will be the topic. And the author of that work and journalist Chandler Burr was Celeste's guest in February of last year. We'll hear that interview again. And on Wednesday, we'll have the governor's annual budget address in the noon hour, probably spilling over into the 1 o'clock hour, and we'll follow that up with comments and analysis. The program opens up the phone lines again on Thursday in the 1 o'clock hour. Computers and You with Greg Klein, the technology journalist for the News Gazette. And then on Friday on the Afternoon Magazine, the 1 o'clock hour, Matthew McAllister, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, will be Celeste's guest. They'll be talking about his work, Blinded by the Sunlight, Emerging from the Prison of Sodom's Iraq. That's what's coming up for the rest of this week in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up at 2, we have a special program, which is called Prime Candidates, taking a look on this President's Day at this year's primary elections by bringing you some stories of some of the past primary campaign, Sarah Vowell included. She'll have some musing on media spun myths and mystiques, or misquotes, that is, probably mystiques too, from the 2000 campaign. That'll be coming up after the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor, which is next here on WILL.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery and Verdant News and Coffee, 17 East Taylor Street in downtown Champaign, a place of inspirations where community and culture converge. Verde Gallery is currently showing Distant Voices Nearer, a celebration of American Indian art.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 16th of February, 2004. It's the third Monday of February, and that makes it President's Day, honoring George Washington, who was born on the 22nd of the month, and Abraham Lincoln, who was born on the 12th. The novelist Richard Ford was born on this day, Jackson, Mississippi, 1944. He grew up across the street from the great novelist and short story writer Eudora Welty. His mother used to point Miss Welty out to him as someone to look up to. And he's written many novels, The Sports Writer, 1985, and Independence Day, 1995. He grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, lived with his grandparents there who managed a hotel. He thought he was going to go into hotel management, but realized he really wanted to major in English. Tried to join the Arkansas State Police, tried a semester at law school, moved to New York City, decided to become a writer. He became a sports writer at Inside Sports magazine covering baseball and college football. He liked it, but then the magazine folded, and he didn't have anything else to do, so he started writing a novel about a sports writer, and that was the novel The Sports Writer, published in 86, and a huge popular and critical success. The novel Independence Day picks up where The Sports Writer left off. Richard Ford, who said, "If loneliness is the disease, the story is the cure." It's the birthday of the critic and biographer Van Wyck Brooks, born in Plainfield, New Jersey, 1886. Wrote biographies early in the 20th century of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Washington Irving, Herman Melville, and Walt Whitman. Van Wyck Brooks, who said, "The American mind, unlike the English, is not formed by books, but newspapers and the Bible." And it's the birthday of the historian and philosopher Henry Adams, born in Boston, 1838, great-grandson of John Adams, grandson of John Quincy, wrote several books on American history, including his 9-volume History of the United States of America during the administrations of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, but best known to us for his rather dark and pessimistic autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams, published in 1918. He wrote that most Americans he encountered had no time for thought. They saw and could see nothing beyond their day's work. Their attitude to the universe outside them was that of deep-sea fish, said Henry Adams. Here's a poem for today, a poem by Robert Bly, entitled "The Resemblance Between Your Life and a Dog." "I never intended to have this life, believe me, it just happened. You know how dogs turn up at a farm, and they wag, but can't explain. It's good if you can accept your life. You'll notice your face has become deranged, trying to adjust to it. Your face thought your life would look like your bedroom mirror when you were 10. That was a clear river touched by mountain wind. Even your parents can't believe how much you've changed. Sparrows in winter, if you've ever held one, all feathers burst out of your hand with a fiery glee. You see them later in hedges. Teachers praise you, but you can't quite get back to the winter sparrow. Your life is a dog. He's been hungry for miles. Doesn't particularly like you, but gives up and comes in." A poem by Robert Bly, "The Resemblance Between Your Life and a Dog," from his collection Eating the Honey of Words, published by HarperCollins, their perennials.